tonight on Arena. Ariane Lebed on filming September Says, and the Marmon Quartet on their new album, Ligeti Bartok String Quartets. Cellist Sinead O'Halloran and violinist Johannes Marmon are two of the award-winning Marmon Quartet, a string ensemble based in London. They are currently in Cork just ahead of their appearance at the Ortus Chamber Music Festival beginning on Wednesday, a festival which Sinead co-founded in 2016 with fellow musician Mairead Hickey. The Marmon Quartet formed at the Royal College of Music in London in 2013, and since then they have built up a formidable reputation on the international touring circuit. They also released their debut album, Ligeti Bartok String Quartets, last month. Sinead O'Halloran and Johannes Marmon join us now from our Cork studio. So Johannes, you would all have met up at the Royal College of Music in London. You were all students there.
That's correct.
And what attracted you all to each other? Was it your interest in avant-garde music, or was it just you were swatting for exams and thought you were good companions to work towards them?
It was actually an interest in the music of Ludwig van Beethoven. And I think that... Beethoven, for string quartet players, for other musicians too, but for string quartet players in particular, I think Beethoven represents the sort of absolute ultimate. You just could not live without Beethoven. So we wanted to start with Beethoven. We'll probably end up still, you know, trying to play Beethoven well in many decades time. So we thought, yeah, we'd start with that, get a head start on the most difficult stuff, basically. And then, went on from there.
And Sinead, were you a cellist in search of a quartet at that time?
Yes. Well, I guess I was really lucky to grow up in Cork, where we had the Vanbrugh Quartet and we had the West Cork Chamber Music Festival. And I always imagined how amazing it would be if I did find the right people to play quartet with. I ended up just joining the Marmons kind of mid-pandemic, actually, in the summer of 2021. And I'm just so, so glad that I found them and they found me.
And were they still playing Beethoven at that stage, or were they now going on to more modern avant-garde music?
Well, I think my first concert with them, we played actually Ligeti's first quartet, which we recorded, and also Beethoven Opus 59 number 3, as well as a Haydn quartet. So I guess what I love about my colleagues is that they're also really keen to play as many different composers as possible. We love playing Haydn. We love playing Mozart. We love also commissioning new works. It's kind of different every week, I guess, which is great.
Now, Johannes, there have been some personnel changes along the way, which I guess is only natural when you're trying to keep the band together.
Yes, it's... quite usual that it happens at some point during a string quartet's life, or at many different points indeed. And I usually liken it to some kind of growing, not necessarily growing pains, but it's a symptom of the quartet morphing into something that perhaps all members did not envisage from the beginning, and you move in different directions and people change as well. And being in a string quartet, the full extent of the challenges of being in a string quartet together only reveal themselves after quite a few years. So when you're young and excited and sort of idealist and so on, there are things you don't really consider, and then
life gets in the way.
Well, not just that, partly that, but Yeah, it's just a very complex thing. It's like with relationships with other people. Some of them last, some of them don't, for various different complicated reasons. And in a string quartet, it's, you know, multiplied. But because you're four people and everyone have interpersonal relationships as well as different group dynamics in different formations. So, yeah, as you said, it's only natural that something like that happens. Yeah.
So Sinead, Ligeti Bartók String Quartets, this is your new album and it has been getting rave reviews. Now, Ligeti is Hungarian by birth, I think, or maybe Romanian by birth and Hungarian by upbringing. And he was a great Bartók fan and wanted to work with Bartók, is that right?
Yes, absolutely. And actually his first quartet is often seen as like Bartók's seventh quartet, because there's, you can really kind of taste the inspiration that has like seeped into his music. And it was just such an incredible journey and a great challenge for us, I guess, recording these masterpieces. But we're really, really happy with how it all turned out.
Yes, because this is hard technical stuff, isn't it? I mean, we'll hear an extract at a moment, which is just terrific in terms of energy and virtuosity. But it does seem difficult.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, they ask things of us that, I guess, in earlier music, you would never have to do things like, you see if you can break as many hairs as possible on your bow by the end, because you're playing with such force. And we did. We broke a lot of hairs on our bows. We also broke a lot of strings in the recording studio. So, it was a great challenge, but so rewarding. And I think we really grew a lot as a quartet.
Well, let's listen to the Marmon Quartet. And here is Tempo de Valse from Ligeti. Yes, I can hear a few strings breaking there. That's Tempo de Valse by Ligeti. Johannes, it is virtuosic, that music of his. Coming together as a group, how do you get that synchronicity going that's presumably necessary?
Yeah. It takes a lot of work. I mean, one of the benefits to being in a string quartet is that you play the same piece in many concerts during a season. Compared to an orchestra, for example, where normally what you do is, in any particular week, you learn a few different pieces, and then you play them in the concert at the end of the week. And then the next week, it's a new batch of pieces that you learn for that week. So you only get to play them once or twice, maybe, each piece. But in a string quartet, you play Ligeti won before having recorded this. We must have played it like at least 20 or 30 times in concert. So it's just like repetition and hard work and discipline and talking about different approaches, breathing together, living together, eating together, all those things.
Things help, Sinead?
I think so, yeah. I mean, there's something quite magical about playing chamber music, I guess, because you kind of end up using all of your senses as well as a sixth sense, I guess, where you have to kind of, you know, really feel each other's energy and communicate not with words. So I guess the more time that we spend with each other, the easier we find it to read each other, I guess, which is only helpful.
We'll come back to the other man in your album, Bartók, in a moment. But tell us a little bit about the Ortus Chamber Music Festival, Sinead.
Sure.
You formed this, but it's not only chamber music. There's a very strong traditional music element as well.
Yes, actually, this year is the first year that we're incorporating trad music as well. And Mairead, my co-founder, she grew
up... Mairead Hickey.
Yes, yeah, she grew up playing trad, and I mean, it's something that I've always loved, and I think the longer I live away from Ireland, the more I crave hearing live trad. So I thought, well, you know, I run this festival, I can make the decision. So I said, yeah, let's add some trad into it this year. So we've got Strung, an incredible contemporary Irish trad band, and also their two fiddlers, Lucia and Maria. They have their own fiddle duo as well. So, yeah, so we'll have fantastic trad and also some of my absolute favourite classical musicians from all over the world. And it's the 10th festival this year, which is really mind-blowing. Mairead and I set it up when we were just teenagers. So it's been really amazing to see how it's evolved. And this year we have 7 concerts all around Cork City and County. And yeah, it's just such a pleasure for me to come back to Cork and share my favourite music and my favourite musicians with my hometown.
Yes, and Sinead, this is becoming quite a thing, isn't it? Musicians making, you know, creating festivals,
yes,
where they can invite other musicians. So you're using your impresario skills as well as your musical skills.
Yeah, and it's amazing to see, actually, because I think when Mairead and I set this up in 2016, there were definitely far fewer festivals in Ireland than there are now. So it's really amazing to see people just saying, okay, let's do something. Let's bring people together. Let's celebrate the amazing culture that we have here and add on to that the amazing people that we've met on our travels. And yeah, it's really something really special.
Now, Bartók is the other composer, and he's the composer, Johannes, that was so inspirational to Ligeti. Tell us a little bit about Bartók.
Well, Bartók was the composer who probably most successfully, at least in the string quartet repertoire, combined the rigorous traditions of Western classical music, you know, like counterpoint and harmonic language and all those forms and structures that had been established all the way back to, you know, Haydn and even before that. But he combined those elements with the elements of folk music from Hungary, but also from all over the region and even going as far as Africa and so on. So his music is very groundbreaking, and I think that the genius of it is how well it blends the folk and the sort of intellectual elements, because they marry in such a way that make them seem less far apart, and that's really beautiful, and it makes people like myself who don't have a background in folk music feel more connected to the folk elements too, because they take a shape within a type of narrative that I'm accustomed to. So Yeah, it's really fantastic.
And now, Sinead, we're going to play the Allegro Molto from Bartok, played by the Marmon. Will you introduce that to us?
Yes, absolutely. So this is the final movement of Bartok's Quartet No. 4 and performed by Johannes Marmon, a Swedish violinist, Laia Valentine Brown, a violinist from Switzerland, Bryony Gibson Cornish from New Zealand, and myself, Sinead O'Halloran from Cork.
Known as the Marmon Quartet. Here
yes.
we go. Allegro Molto there from Bartok, performed by the Allegro Quartet. Both are string quartets, both the Ligeti and the Bartok are string quartets from the Marmon Quartet's debut album, Ligeti Bartok String Quartets, and that was released in January 2025. What else have we to look forward to at the Ortus Chamber Music Festival, Sinead?
Well, we will be joined by fantastic Slovenian clarinetist Aljaž Baguš, and we'll be playing some of the best repertoire for clarinet and strings, including, well, two of my favourite clarinet quintets, Brahms, which I think most people know, but also a lesser known quintet by Arthur Bliss, which is just, we think, really phenomenal and deserves to be played as much as possible. I'm also playing the world premiere of a new cello suite by Ben Dwyer, which was written for me, which is very exciting. It's always really cool to bring things to life. And we'll also have a prize winners concert on Wednesday at 1 p.m. at St. Peter's, which features the prize winners of various competitions at the MTU Cork School of Music, as well as a festival string orchestra where we'll play the European premiere of Bryony Gibson Cornish's Viola Concerto. And that will be festival musicians and some really fantastic students of the MTU Cork School of Music. So all of the details are on ortusfestival.ie. And as I said, we have 7 concerts all around Cork City and County between the 26th of February and the 2nd of March.
So Sinead O'Halloran, thank you so much. And
pleasure.
Johannes Marmon, the best of luck with the Ortus Chamber Music Festival, which runs from February the 22nd to March the 2nd. Further details from ortusfestival.ie. September Says is a film about sibling rivalry. July and September are the siblings in question. They have a very intense bond in which September is the boss. Bullying at school moves the family from England to Ireland, where things take a turn for the worse. The film was inspired by Daisy Johnson's novel Sisters and is directed by actress and first-time feature director Ariane Lebed. And I'm delighted to be joined by Ariane Lebed now. Ariane, you're best known as an actress. Irish audiences will know you from films such as The Lobster and Souvenir 2. You were approached by Element Pictures with this project. What did they pitch to you?
Hi, good evening. Yeah, I was very surprised and very happy that that Element Pictures, together with BBC Film, thought of me for the adaptation of this book. They didn't tell me much first. They just told me, "Would you like to read this book? We think, you know, it might interest you." And they were so right.
And what was it then about? Tell us a little bit about Sisters by Daisy Johnson, and why did it light a flame within you?
Yeah, I think I fell in love completely with the characters. That was the first thing. I never really had encountered in any fiction two sisters with that kind of dynamic. It is, as you mentioned, quite toxic, or there's something very dark about it, but it's way more complex than that. And also, it's they are 15 and 16 years old, and I was very interested already about, you know, that period of time. Teenagehood is, I think, very, very deep and important period of time for all of us. And the fact that it was only female characters was also something that attracted me. And I think there is something in Daisy Johnson's writing that I completely rely to. It's the fact that she is really into details, and she really has a way to describe everyday life, you know, little things that we all do, something that really seems normal at first, and how she managed to twist those things to something way more weird, and sometimes, you know, to something fantastic.
And like, have you, Ariane, have you sisters in your own family?
I have two sisters, yeah.
All right. So were there things you could relate to in Daisy's book?
Yeah, probably. But, you know, I have a, I think, way more healthy relationship with my sisters. One of them actually came on set and worked with me on the film, and we are very close, and we love each other. And I think a healthier way than July and September. But of course, it also inspired me a lot to do the adaptation, because I was lucky enough to have Daisy Johnson herself telling me that I'm free to adapt her book the way I want. So I could really put my own things in it, transform a bit the timeline, the story. So I was really blessed by that.
Great. Well, I was suggesting the intensity of the sisters' relationship, not the spookiness that you bring to the film. Let's listen to a clip so people get an idea of September Says. Here are the sisters, July, played by Mia Tharia, and September, played by Pascal Kahn, play a game called September Says.
September Says, turn around. September says, touch your nose with your tongue. Do 10 push-ups. You lose life.
Silly me.
September says, engrave my name on that window pane.
That scraping of her engraving September's name on the windowpane is really chilling.
Yeah, I know. And I think you choose the very painful part sound-wise for radio to play, which is great.
Yes, I thought it would really work. It really does. bring us into this dynamic of the world of the two girls and their mother. It's very much a closed room, a closed house a lot of the time until they interact with the outside world.
Yeah, it was important for me that we kind of understand at the beginning of the film that September and July are having a hard time at school, that they are bullied by, you know, the other student in high school. And that's why, I guess, you know, they have this need to create almost like a language at home. So they create this world where they feel safe in, and they live with their single mom. And it's like this little bubble, which I think every family does that, even if they don't notice. But, you know, we have a way of communicating, a rhythm or something that is really just belong to your own family. So, but we can see that for them, it's becoming almost an entire new world that they live in, which is closer to animal, with something that has to do with animals and something to do with body language more than something that might seem logical. So they have created another logic somehow.
Yes, let's listen to a clip which isn't that different from the previous clip, but gets a little bit deeper into that that very bad dynamic between the sisters.
If I die, will you die too?
Yes.
If one of us had to die, and we could choose which one, would you die in my place?
Yes. Of course, it would be me.
You promise?
Yes. Yes.
Say it to my reflection, too.
If only one of us could remain, it would be you.
Oh, it's so chilling. Ariane, when the family then, something terrible happens in the family and it means that they move to Ireland. I don't think they move to Ireland in the book. I think that's something that you worked with Element Pictures to create. Why the move to Ireland? They move to a coastal, well, town or more or less a rural setting near a coast in Ireland.
Yeah, that's right. Because we developed it with Element Picture, we decided to shoot the film in Ireland. And I think really the coast near Dublin really, you know, I think bring this atmosphere of Gothic novel that the film is adapted from. So I really love the fact that we could use this beautiful Irish landscape into the film and kind of completely made sense. And also, I thought it was interesting to have in the first part, we don't exactly know why it is in the UK, but we understand that the accent of the student and everybody around them are British, and then we move to somewhere else. So there's also the feeling that they are a bit of like outsiders when they go to the countryside, which I think was interesting too.
Yes, and the third character, who is a very important character, is Sheila, their mother. And their mother is a very caring, loving mother and creates these little homes within homes to kind of nurture and cherish the girls. But she is a woman with her own needs. She's lonely, she's separated. She too wants a romantic life, a sexual life.
Yeah, it was important for me to portray a woman, a mother like that. I think we, most of the time in fictions, we are used to mothers that are all, you know, almost crazy or very mean or this kind of very caring figure. And I think mothers are way more complex than that. They are women. So, of course, they do care about their children. They try their best. Of course, they fail. They try, but I think it's very difficult to actually, you know, be a mother. And I wanted to show that she's trying her best, but she's still a woman as well, and she has needs. And I really wanted to give that space for her to exist as a person and not only as a mother. It was really important to me.
Yes, there's a great scene where the mother, Sheila, goes to a bar and picks up an Irish man in the Irish bar and brings him home. And we have this kind of internal monologue of her feelings while they get it on in the bedroom.
Yeah, that was very important to me too, to have her point of view during that scene, the lady, to be really close to what she's going through. And I think in all, you know, also to make the scene a bit funnier. And I think sex in cinema in general is always portrayed as something very serious and very, I don't know, glamorous or something like that. And I had this need, I think, to portray a sex scene that is really, you know, equal, easy. We're with this woman who she's having her own thoughts. There's no penetration. So it's a very equal relationship. with a tone that is maybe the lightest that we have in the film, really.
Yes, indeed it is. Yeah, it's very funny. Ariane, you know the two clips we heard there of the two girls, they're working in unison together and it gets just very uncomfortable to watch. How did you work with the two young actresses? You being an actress must have brought a great help and great knowledge to those scenes.
Yeah, because I also come from dance, for me it's very important to work physically. So the time we spent together with the three actors was really working on physicality and trying to get rid of all this social, manière that we have. That's just to try to go back to the core of things and to something raw. So we spent quite a long time playing animals and playing games and trying to feel to find this rhythm that would become the rhythm of that family. So it was not really spending time on the page and on the scene. It was really trying to find what physical language would this family have, and we had a lot of fun doing that, which I think is one of the most important thing. And I was lucky enough to find these three amazing ladies that I deeply love. And I also know that, you know, if it was a different casting, it would be a different film, that we all created that family together. And I'm very grateful.
How do you describe September Says? Do you say it's a psychological thriller? It's a gothic horror? How would you describe it? You mightn't want to describe it like anything.
I don't. I mean, I'm kind of playing with the genre. It almost starts like a coming-of-age film. And then I'm trying to guide the audience towards something closer to, maybe a psychological thriller. And then it becomes something more gothic. So for me, it's kind of a journey in between different genres. So I don't really think we can exactly say what September Says is, which is something I really like.
Indeed. Well, Ariane Lebed, so nice to talk to you. And September Says is in cinemas now. In books like The Rose Grower, The Lost Dog, Scary Monsters and The Life to Come, Australian writer Michelle de Kretser has experimented daringly with form. In her latest book, Theory and Practice, a novel is begun and abruptly halted by its author, who decides to tell us a story from her college life instead. Cindy, our narrator, takes us back to 1986 when she was 24 and has just moved from Sydney to St Kilda's in Melbourne to begin a postgrad on the novels of Virginia Woolf. It's an exciting place full of artists and activities, and the air is full of radical ideas. I'm delighted to be joined by Michelle de Kretser, and she's on the line from Sydney. So, Michelle, you opened open Theory and Practice with a false start. We were in a story of a young Australian wandering around Europe recalling his outback childhood. And then on page 22, you step in as the author and say, at that point, the novel I was writing stalled. So then we go into Cindy's story. So why did you use that framing device?
Oh, thank you so much. I used it for a couple of reasons. The first was that it's quite a conventional, realist opening. And I wanted to set that against what comes next, which reads like nonfiction, but is, of course, fiction. And when you say something is fiction and then what follows is the truth, it makes what follows seem even truer. So it's like setting black next to white. Both colors look sharper. So that was one reason. And the other reason was that by the time you get to the end of the novel, which purports to tell the truth about the life of a novelist, you see where some of the key elements of that fictional story at the beginning come from. So how she has transformed those elements from her life into fiction, which is a question that I often get and novelists often get, you know, where do these stories come from? So here was a suggestion, a playful one, about how writers transform, you know, what happens to them, experience, into story.
Now, the book is called Theory and Practice, and it really is an exploration of, it's fine having a theory, but putting it into practice is a whole different ballgame completely. And as I said, St Kilda's in Melbourne is portrayed as this exciting place with students doing really interesting critiques in literature. But then there's this new dogma of theory. Tell me a little bit about how this idea of theory comes into the humanities, study of humanities.
Well, in the 1980s, French post-structuralist theory really swept university departments, and it was particularly strong at the University of Melbourne, which is where the narrator in the book is studying. The prevalent form of theory was deconstruction. So it was very focused on the work of Derrida and his US-based disciples, very focused on the canon, and written in a language that was very difficult for anyone not coming out of a background of continental philosophy to understand. And so the narrator in the book feels rather dismayed that she has all her undergraduate studies and are worthless because she has to master a whole new way of reading. At the same time, it's upending all kinds of conventions. It's upending her understanding of the world. So it is exciting on the page, but how she puts that into practice in her life or in the work she's trying to do is very complicated. So there is always this gap in this novel between the theory and the practice, as you said.
Now, she is a devotee of Virginia Woolf. Virginia Woolf, as a writer, opened her mind to literature and how women could live in the world as writers and creative people. But then, through her own reading of Virginia Woolf's diaries, she finds a Virginia Woolf that she doesn't like, because in if you're looking at it from a colonial point of view, it is, you know, she has some rather racist views of people.
Well, yes. So the narrator is a Sri Lankan migrant to Australia. And she is, of course, completely dismayed by this particular passage that she comes across in Woolf's diaries, where Woolf makes very derogatory comments about a Sri Lankan activist who's visiting her husband, Leonard Woolf. And I suppose I just wanted to explore what we do with our complicated feelings when a cultural icon, someone we revere, is shown to be flawed. And I think that that is a situation in which, as I think it was, Richard Wright who said, there is a moment, a quiet spell that comes over a reader when you realize that this person is not all you thought them to be. And that is what happens to the narrator of Theory and Practice. But then she has to learn to accommodate Woolf's complexity, her complexity as a person. And, you know, there is at first what seems to be a complete gap between Woolf's theories of women's lives and her practice of those theories. as indeed there are in the narrator's own life, who is a feminist, and yet, you know, does and says and thinks very unfeminist things on many an occasion.
Yes, this is where a lot of the fun comes in theory and practice, because our narrator is studying the work of Virginia Woolf. The head of her department is believes in feminist theory, and as does and every, you know, most of the women in the mm-hmm. class are feminists. But when it comes then to relationships, there's a whole different story. Feminism doesn't come into sleeping with another student's boyfriend and the hate and vitriol she pours upon the person she's actually betraying in this adulterous relationship.
Yes, indeed. So there is certainly a gap between, you know, her feminist practice, her feminist theory in that case, and her practice. She also has good relationships with other women, but in this particular instance, she is at best petty about this woman whom she constructs as her rival. I think that these feelings that are very rarely explored in serious literature. And I think it is always interesting to try to articulate complex feelings that cause shame and that are silenced because of the shame they arouse in the person who's feeling them. And that's what I tried to do in this novel.
Yes, because the woman in question is called Olivia, and the narrator meets Olivia then for a cup of coffee, and they have a discussion about Simone de Beauvoir and various other mm-hmm. feminist characters, and we as readers realize that these two women have much more in common than the narrator and the man in question, who is
yes.
Kit, and yet at the end of the event, where they have this meeting and they get on so well, she gets a call from Kit and she's delighted and again pours more vitriol on the woman.
So it's yes, yes, indeed. It's complex, isn't it? It's that messy gap between one's ideals and values and one's actions. And I think that literature really feeds on that kind of complexity and mess, that it is energized by it, because literature, art in general, you know, thrives on contradiction and complexity. And that, as I said, was the area that's very tricky terrain that I tried to map. Well, you can't say someone, the protagonist of this book, is, you know, a wholly admirable person, but nor is she wholly evil either. She's very human, I think, as is, of course, Virginia Woolf.
Yes, the Virginia Woolf, the book, one of the books that the narrator is interested in writing her thesis on is The Years. And The Years was Virginia Woolf's idea that she could write a novel or a book which merged ideas of the novel with the essay. In some ways, rather what you're doing in theory and practice.
Yes, indeed. So it was absolutely the inspiration for the form of theory and practice. So Woolf had this idea of, you know, a chapter of fiction followed by an essay, chapter of fiction followed by an essay. And that was in her original draft, which was about 100,000 words long. That's what she did. And then she abandoned it. It just wasn't working, I suspect. It was just too stiff. Too difficult to make that very strict alternation work as a form. But what I thought I would do would be to have a much more tangled form where essay or nonfiction. So essay and memoir and fiction merge and blend with each other. Sometimes I think the reader can tell very easily what is nonfiction. I mean, obviously, anything relating to Woolf's life is nonfiction. And other times, I think the reader can't tell what is fact and what is fiction. That gave me something very malleable to work with. I mean, that alternation, very strict alternation between what Woolf called the granite of truth and the vision of fiction. I felt that if that didn't work for Woolf, it wouldn't work for me. You know, I wanted this much more, just a much more tangled form, really, yes. A more plastic form.
Yes, you give it a very colloquial name called the carrier bag novel.
Yes, well, that comes from, as you know, Le Guin's carrier bag theory of fiction, where Le Guin said that the kind of narrative we've been taught to value is the narrative of the hero's journey, where, you know, a protagonist sets off from home, goes out into the world, has experiences, conquers the world, comes home, is celebrated, tells his story. And the protagonist doesn't have, the hero doesn't have to be a man, but usually is. And this is what's known as the hero's journey. And Le Guin argued that comes down to us from hunter-gatherer societies, where people, usually young men, go off on a hunt, successfully hunt, slaughter mm-hmm. A beast, and come home and share the spoils, and there's a feast, and they are celebrated, and they tell the story of the hunt. And she pointed out that actually hunter-gatherer societies didn't live by hunting, which happened very rarely. They lived by gathering. And gathering was a collective activity in which everyone went out and foraged food. And that would mean edible seeds, it would mean berries, fruit, edible grasses, perhaps a fish from a fish trap, yes. Perhaps some bird's eggs. Yes. And so the idea was to have a novel in which you could put lots of disparate things and it would be like a carrier bag. So you could have fact, fiction, whatever you wanted in this carrier bag of a novel.
Well, Michelle, that's definitely what we get in theory and practice. And it's great to be able to fish in and get out lots of delights from theory and practice. It's published by Sorts of Books. Michelle de Kretzer, thank you so much for talking to us. That's it for tonight's show. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy were the researchers. Jamie Doyle was on sound. Ollie Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Sinead Egan. John Creedon is next.